Thank you very much. And thank you very much to the organizers of the workshop on quantum matter and quantum materials for inviting me. So I've really learned a lot in the last few days. So this is going to be something completely different from what we've been talking about. So as Lith mentioned, I'm an astrophysicist. So this will be an astrophysicist's perspective on quantum materials and how important they are for us to be able to detect gravitational waves in particular. So I'm speaking on behalf of the LIGO team at UBC. So this is a team that has astrophysicists. So this is my research group, plus three other labs in the Stuart-Blossom Quantum Matter Institute that are working on advancing the detection of gravitational waves. So you can see a few faces here. So on the right, there are a couple postdocs. That's Matthew Mitchell and Kirsty Gardner, whose work we'll be hearing about a little bit later on, and some of their capstone students. And then as well, we have another picture of Kirsty and the three faculty PIs who are each contributing to the study of coating materials. So these are really thin film coatings that we use on our optics in our gravitational wave interferometers to make these really sensitive detections. So with that in mind, we're going to start pretty much from the very beginning. So gravitational waves as a new window into the universe. And what makes them really special is that they're very, very weakly interacting. And what this means is that it makes them very difficult to detect, as we'll see later. So we require these advances in quantum materials in particular in order to make our detectors sensitive enough to detect these sources. It also means that they travel through vast distances of space, essentially unaffected. So unlike astronomy with light and electromagnetic radiation, which has interference from dust and gas and is blocked by the Earth as it's rotating, so gravitational waves are going to propagate for billions of years and carry this really crystal clear signature of the dynamics of the sources that produce them. All right, so let's get a sense of what we might see in terms of gravitational waves. So this is a simulation of a source. This is actually the first source that we detected. If we had a perfect telescope and also an unrealistically dense stellar field, this is what we might see with the telescope. So we've got two black holes. They're orbiting around each other, and then they merge. And now let's take a look at the same system in the lens of space-time. So here we're going to see the same system. So these are two black holes, roughly about 30 times the mass of the sun. And the color here now is the curvature of space-time. So as these two black holes are orbiting, they're radiating away energy in the form of gravitational waves. And this is going to spin up their orbit. This is going to make them spin closer and closer together until they merge. So the time series that you can see at the bottom of the simulation by the SXS collaboration is actually tracing out this gravitational wave amplitude. So this is the signature that we hope to detect with gravitational wave detectors. And just as we expect from general relativity, so as these two black holes get close together, they're going to start to merge. And this is the signal, the point at the signal where we see the highest amplitude as they merge together, and then this final black hole is going to ring down like a bell, and this entire signal is going to propagate out at the speed of light, and again travel for many billions of light years until it gets to us, the observer. So how do we sense these kinds of signals? So we can leverage what we know about general relativity to predict what the amplitude should be from a source. So we have this equation here on the left. So this is telling me about the amplitude of space-time strain that I, the observer, would see. And the first thing that you might notice is that this is proportional to a small number divided by a very, very large number. So already here we have an intuition that this is going to be a very small effect. Something else you might notice is that it's proportional to the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment of the system. So this is telling me that I'm going to need something asymmetric and accelerating in order to generate gravitational waves. And then the last thing I want you to notice is that this amplitude, the strength of the signal, is proportional to 1 over r, where R is the distance between me, the observer, and my source. So unlike if I'm an astronomer using light or counting photons in a photodiode, where the strength of my signal is going to go as 1 over R squared, here the strength of my signal is going to go directly as 1 over R. So we're going to see the gravitational waves can probe really vast distances, and we'll start to get a sense of that from these results. All right, so how does this work exactly if I've got a gravitational wave that's inducing the stretching and squeezing effect that we saw on the last slide? So my goal here is to measure this change in relative length into orthogonal degrees of freedom. This is motivated by this expected effect as this gravitational wave is passing through spacetime. So I am motivated to choose a detector that's going to be able to probe these two perpendicular degrees of freedom. So one of the ways that we might think to do this is with an interferometer. So let's see what this looks like. So this is a basic Michelson interferometer. We start with some coherent laser light. And if we have some gravitational wave passing into the plane of the detector, this will induce some relative change in length. So let's follow the beam path here. So 50% of the light splits in each one of those two orthogonal directions. And we're going to use color to trace their relative path. So if there's no incident gravitational wave, and there's no relative change in length of the detector, then to first order, we see very little in our photodiode. However, if you do introduce a gravitational wave into the plane of the detector, you'll get this relative stretching and squeezing effect. This will produce a change in phase of the light that's traveling in each one of the arms, and we can register this interference at our photodiode. So we can actually directly read out from the system what the amplitude of the incident gravitational wave is. So we have three detectors that use basically this technology currently. So this is a snapshot of this global gravitational wave detector network as it was in the most recent observing run. So this is broken up into two parts from April 2019 to March 2020, cut a little bit short by COVID. So there are two LIGO detectors that were online, and we expect to be online again for our next observing run in March. So this is LIGO Livingston, which is in the Pacific Northwest, close to UBC, and also LIGO Hanford in the Pacific Northwest, LIGO Livingston down in Louisiana. So these are both 4-kilometer-long arm detectors. So that means the Michelson that we were just looking at, those arm lengths would be on the scale of 4 kilometers each. We also have a sister detector, Virgo in Italy, with 3-kilometer-long arms. And then there's GEO-600, which is a 600-meter detector that's prototyped a lot of the really key technologies that we've been leveraging. There's a planned third LIGO detector to be built in LIGO India. And then there's also Kagra, which is a cryogenic underground 3-kilometer detector in Japan. But before we get into recent results, I want to take you on a tour of how this all came to be. So a brief history of the LIGO detectors in particular. So how did we get here? So the first date that I want to mention is all the way back in 1973, the very first conceptual design by Ray Weiss at MIT. And it was actually more than 15 years after that, before there was a proposal to the NSF for the construction of LIGO. And then beyond this, when construction began in 1994, in parallel, the prototyping was happening for the key technologies that we would need in order to make these detectors run. So the laser systems, the optics, the seismic isolation, all of this was happening in parallel and has decades of prior development before initial LIGO started observing. But we did start observing in 2002. And we produced our very first set of upper limits. So this part of the story can sometimes be a little bit washed out, that we had many years where we didn't make any detections. So we used to call these science runs. So this is science runs 1 through 5, where we became increasingly confident that we had not observed any gravitational waves. That was our major result. And I joined the collaboration myself as an undergraduate just at the tail end of this period here. And then as I started graduate school, we had enhanced LIGO operation, where the LIGO detectors were successfully improved. So we pushed our relative noise down, and we came away with better upper limits. So we were more confident about what we had not seen. And this took us all the way up until 2010, where we had been running the LIGO detectors and the Virgo detector, and GEO-600 as well, without any detections. And then this brings us to the period that happened to overlap for pretty much the entirety of my PhD experience. So this is the installation of the advanced LIGO detectors. So this essentially means that the instrumentation inside those vacuum chambers was stripped out and replaced. So improved laser systems, improved optics, and improved seismic isolation. And at the end of this 5-year period, we intended to begin our very first observing run. And you may know this part of the story now, that before we were even ready to officially start, we have this great big beautiful signal. So this is a really remarkable thing, to go from not seeing anything, and the first time that we have a candidate signal, it's not a hint, it's not something subtle in the data, it's this screaming loud SNR of 20 beautiful signal that's very clear in the data of both detectors. So this was about 2 weeks, roughly, before we were meant to formally start the observing run, also about 2 weeks into my first postdoc at Caltech when I was based in LIGO Livingston. And this is a really, really exciting period, but also a very chaotic one as we were trying to validate this candidate event as astrophysical. And we came away from that 3-month observing run with not just one detection, but depending on how you count, 3. So these are now all 3 confident events that we're claiming are astrophysical signals. All in all, we came away with about one detection per month. And what you're looking at here is a schematic that's showing the mass of each one of the objects involved. So you have those 2 component black holes that merge into a final black hole. So always we'll see mass measurements come in triples for LIGO and Virgo measurements. And just relative to the information that we had about the measured masses of black holes from X-ray binaries, they're in purple. So here's where we were at the end of 01. So we had a period of improvement before the second observing run, and we had our next really big discovery. So this is data from LIGO and also Virgo, showing the signal track for the very first binary neutron star merger detected with gravitational waves. So you might notice the time scale here is much, much different. So the first detection that we were looking at was happening over about on the order of milliseconds. We're here now, we have tens of seconds, and this is because these lower mass signals will stay in the sensitive band of the detector for much longer since they merge at higher frequencies. So we can see this really, really clear signal track in the detectors, and what makes this event so special is that the matter in these neutron stars produce this really spectacular electromagnetic counterpart. So here's a simulation that shows the 2 neutron stars. They're emitting gravitational waves as they inspiral closer and closer together, and then the tidal forces are going to start to tear them apart and produce a burst of gamma rays and this incredibly neutron-rich environment. And so this signal was detected electromagnetically all across the spectrum from gamma rays all the way to radio. Astronomers are still studying how it's evolving in time, and it's a really, really rich multi-messenger source. And that's not all that we detected in the second observing run. So here's a snapshot of where we ended up. We also had roughly about 8 more binary black hole detections. And now here we're starting to see a pretty clear pattern relative to black holes where we were able to measure the mass with electromagnetic radiation in purple. We're starting to see hints of this population of heavier black hole masses emerging from these gravitational wave observations. And with this increase in sensitivity relative to the first observing run, now we're up to about a detection every 2.5 weeks or so. And then we had our next periods of upgrades preparing for this latest, most recent observing run. So again, this was April 2019 to March of 2020. And here's the full spectrum of results from this run. So with the increases in sensitivity for O3, this latest observing run, we were up to a little bit better than one detection per week. And now we're starting to see gravitational waves. So these are all the triple systems that you see here plotted with the x-axis being totally arbitrary, just the y-axis being important. So gravitational waves are starting to dominate what we know about compact objects. And it's a little bit hard to see from this plot. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to transform this into an x-axis of distance to show you that these are also much, much more distant than compact objects that we've measured their masses with light. So here's another version of this plot. It has the same y-axis. So this is the mass of the object in solar masses. And now here we have distance in kiloparsecs. And each one of the blue dots that you see is a measured mass with gravitational waves, where again, we expect these all to come in triples with the same distance. And green dots are black holes with masses estimated with electromagnetic radiation. And purple are neutron stars. So I've plotted some helpful markers here. So we've got the Milky Way center here. Then here's the edge of the Milky Way, where we do have some mass measurements just beyond the edge of the Milky Way and some of the smaller satellite galaxies. But it's really at very distant galaxies that we're seeing these gravitational wave signals. And some of them are over 5 billion light years away. And how do we know how distant they are and how massive they are? So I'll show you a cartoon idea that leverages the fact that we expect general relativity to predict exactly what these signals should be. So we're going to use that GR model. We're going to plot that in this orange curve here. And we're going to compare this to our detector data in blue. So let's see what happens when I evolve the model in mass. So we're going to match this up in phase with our data. So as we are decreasing the mass, we're going to find that good match with the data in phase. And then we're going to be able to scale this directly to the amplitude of our data to estimate the distance. So remember all the way back to the first equation that we saw, where we expect the amplitude of the data of the strain that we, the observer, will see, that's going to scale as just 1 over the distance. So if we have a very good model for what that signal should look like, we can directly infer the distance. So this is a really powerful tool in astronomy where distance is otherwise really, really hard to measure. A question? Yes? That's a really good question. So I think I'm going to repeat it. So the question is, do we assume that the gravitational wave travels through the vacuum or some interstellar medium? And it turns out that gravitational waves are weakly interacting enough that that isn't going to make a difference. So I can assume that it travels through a vacuum. Maybe it passes through a galaxy. Maybe it passes through multiple galaxies. There's some possibility we could see some lensing effects. But in terms of the model that I see, we don't generally take that into account. But excellent question. All right, so of course it's not so easy in practice for us to infer what these sources are. So we do use a fully Bayesian treatment where essentially we model this data as the sum of the signal as seen through the lens of our detector network plus some detector noise. And the way that we construct the likelihood of the noise is that we expect when we subtract that signal model, if it is a good match, from the data, that that residual noise should be consistent with Gaussian noise. And it turns out that this is very much not always a good approximation. So this is actually something that my own research lab spends a lot of our time thinking about. But this is the general process that produces the results that you see here. So I've shown some posterior distributions for each one of the component masses of essentially the first half of the catalog from the most recent observing run. So we call this arbitrarily mass one would be the heavier of the two masses that in spiral, and then mass two, and you're seeing a violin plot in terms of mass in units of solar mass. And we can also infer something about the spin. So the spin will also leave an imprint on the signature of the gravitational wave that we can infer. So just to give you an idea of what we're able to measure so far, so this is an example 1904-12. So the magnitude here is the magnitude of the spin and the direction is relative to the orbital angular momentum. So we generally have much better information about this heavier system. So this is 1 and 2 again, where 2 is the lighter of the two components. So we are able to constrain the heavier mass spin fairly well for some systems and less well for others. And we require improvement to our gravitational wave detectors to be able to do better than this and start to make some really exciting inferences about spin and eccentricity that could tell us about how these systems form. So we can actually do quite a lot with gravitational waves in terms of fundamental physics and cosmology in addition to astrophysics. So we talked about how gravitational waves give us this independent measurement of the distance. So this means, coupled with redshift, we can use gravitational waves to produce this independent measurement of the Hubble constants and eventually infer the Hubble constant as a function of redshift out to cosmological distances, which is really exciting. We can also get insights into highly dense matter, so both as neutron stars are tearing each other apart and leaving that signature in a neutron star merger signal, and also from spinning neutron stars in our own galaxy. So two different ways of looking at the neutron star equation of state with gravitational waves. We also are able to do these really precise tests of general relativity in this very extreme space-time curvature. And of course, we're starting to see the census of what the true distribution of stellar remnants is emerging now for the first time from gravitational waves. So how do we do this exactly? So you might be thinking back to our very simple Michelson and thinking, well, I don't know if that's going to get us there. And it turns out that you would be right. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take a tour of a detector. So we're going to start zoomed all the way out at LIGO Hanford. And this is actually a mid station here. This is only 2 kilometers out relative to the corner station. And what we're going to do is we're going to zoom all the way into where the laser starts. And we're going to follow the laser around in its path in the detector just to build an intuition for how complicated this process is in practice. So we're going to start from the pre-stabilized laser. So this is stabilized in amplitude and frequency. And this is steered into a 3-optic cavity in pink here that's called the input mode cleaner. And what this does is it selects for this fundamental Gaussian spatial mode, so this nice well-behaved light. That's then steered into another 3-optic cavity in this kind of green-yellow color. This is called the power cycling cavity, and what it will do is recycle the light that exits the beam splitter, but for now it passes straight onto the beam splitter, and just as we saw earlier, it will split 50% in each direction, and the light will travel down both of the arms. So now we're going to zoom all the way out and get the sense of the benefits of lining each side of each one of our arms with a highly reflective optic. So what this is going to do, this is called a Fabry-Perot cavity, it's going to cycle that light power up by a factor of 300. So we start from roughly about 150 watts in our pre-stabilized laser, we can cycle that light up to about 0.5 megawatt in the arms. So we zoom all the way down to the end station, we're going to get a look at one of these, we call them test mass optics, these are the core optics that are cycling the light in the arms. So they weigh about 90 pounds. And they're hung from those very thin fibers that you saw. This is to help us to reduce that thermal noise. And then the light finishes its journey in the arms. So what it's going to do, it's going to come back to the beam splitter. Half of it will be recycled in the power recycling cavity. And then the other half will travel down to the signal recycling cavity, which serves a similar purpose to first order. And then finally to this bow tie cavity called the output mode cleaner, and then to our photodiode. So all of these different optical cavities, we need to keep in resonance at all time to be able to take data. And what's going to happen if we have a gravitational wave incident into the plane of the detector? This is going to induce this relative stretching and squeezing of the arms. And this is what we'd expect to see in our output optics. To give you a sense of the scale and the complexity to leading order of the measurement that we can make. And then this is the data from the very first detection of gravitational waves. So what adds to the noise of a gravitational wave detector? So we'll talk a little bit about these fundamental noise sources, But essentially, there are two main kinds of noise. So we're again trying to sense this relative change in length between these two arms. So the first kind of noise is limitations in our ability to sense those relative changes. So these are mostly high frequency effects. So this is shot noise, which essentially is coming from the uncertainty in the photon phase and amplitude. And then the second type of noise is noise that actually introduces a physical change in the relative length of the arms. So this is ground motion, and also what's contributing here, or what will be contributing once we come to rest at design sensitivity, is the thermal Brownian motion of the coatings on the optics. So these are highly reflective coatings, again, that we need in order to cycle the light up enough to reduce the noise in this part of the spectrum. But this thermal noise is fundamentally limiting. And one more note that I want to make before we move on to focus on quantum materials and coatings in particular is that if you're wondering how did we go from seeing nothing from 2002 to 2010 to seeing signals with SNRs of tens suddenly, so in my opinion, the answer is this system here. So these are the technologies that we use to mitigate noise in each of these different frequency ranges. And down at low frequencies, we're dominated by this seismic noise. And the way that we were able to reduce this noise by many orders of magnitude at roughly about 50 hertz, which is where many of these binary black holes will enter our sensitivity band. So what you're looking at here is actually active seismic isolation, where the pier that's supporting the instrumentation is actually isolated from the ground, and what we do is we measure the ground motion, and then we model how that pier is going to respond to the ground motion and actively push on it to cancel it out, sort of like your noise-canceling headphones will work. So this is responsible for a great deal of the sensitivity improvements at lower frequencies, but what I'd like to focus on is this optics encoding noise. So here are some images just to give you, again, a sense of the scale and reality of how large these optics are. And it's also worth noting that, well, maybe it's a little bit hard to see here, but there are, again, these very, very thin fibers also made of fused silica, which is what we use for the substrate of our optics. That's also going to help us limit the thermal noise, which is part of the reason why that this coatings thermal noise dominates. So let's take a look at the noise budget. So here is my measured noise here in blue. And we have this quantum noise sweeping through here, where this is mostly shot noise up at higher frequencies and radiation pressure down at low frequencies. And we have this, this big dashed yellow line here that's popping up over the quantum noise. And that means that it's fundamentally limiting to our ability to sense gravitational waves. So we are going to have to improve this performance in order to be able to see any farther out into space. And the reason that I say this is because we have the same optical coating recipe that we've been using since the beginning of the Advanced LIGO project. And we're now coming down to rest on this fundamentally limiting line. So we're not going to be able to press down any further, no matter how clever we are with light squeezing or seismic isolation. We're not going to be able to see any further out into space unless we solve this quantum materials problem of limiting this thermal noise. But this is a snapshot of where we are, which is a really exciting place to be. So we do expect to achieve that design sensitivity in the next observing run, which is starting in March. And to give you a sense of what this buys us, all of these technology improvements all in all, so we're going to get a sense of the scale of the relative length change that we're able to measure. So we start by zooming around with the electron outside of a hydrogen atom. We're going to zoom all the way into the surface of the proton, and we're going to see to scale the relative length measurements that we're able to make. And I'll note that the simulation was made in 2016 for the first detection. We're doing roughly about a factor of two better than this now. All right, so here is our roadmap to design sensitivity. So that is our goal, where we will come to rest on this quantum materials noise. So you're seeing an array of different sensitivity curves, starting from the first observing run, which we call O1, all the way down to this pink curve here. So this is O3 for Hanford and a green curve that's O3 for Livingston. So in O3, again, we were able to make a little bit better than one detection per week. And where we're going for design sensitivity starting in March, it's going to be, we expect a signal per day. So that's at least one confident gold-plated detection per day is the expectation. And then beyond this, so beyond the next observing run, which is O4, we're headed to O5. So this is this pink line here, which we call A+, which will again require necessarily some improvements in this material coating design for our optics. So I'll give you a sense of the spectrum of next generation detectors looking even beyond that. So what we just talked about, this advanced LIGO Plus and advanced Virgo Plus. So these would be inside the same vacuum facilities that we currently have at the LIGO and Virgo detectors. And we would require, again, new optics, new coatings, but the same laser and the same room temperature that we've been using. The next step that we're looking at, so on the order of the end of the decade, would be something called Voyager. So this would be a cryogenic detector with a potentially an entirely new type of material used for the substrate that would be installed into the current advanced LIGO vacuum infrastructure. And then looking even farther beyond that, so on the scale of potentially decades from now, there's a European design called the Einstein Telescope. So this is a triangular design similar to LISA, the space antenna. And this would also be a cryogenic and room temperature xylophone design, which would also require some advancements in quantum materials. And then what I'd like to spend a bit of time talking about is this US-based design, Cosmic Explorer. So this would increase the baseline by a factor of about 10. That's the plan. And we have a plan for phase 1 and phase 2. So this is phase 1 at room temperature, and then phase 2, which would be cryogenic following the prototyping from Voyager. So this is the spectrum of what the community is currently planning in terms of future generation detectors. What does this mean in terms of the sense of scale? So in orange here is the current generation. Sometimes you'll hear people call this the second generation or 2G. And then Einstein Telescope, which is a 10-kilometer baseline design next to it, and then 40 kilometers, which would be the Cosmic Explorer baseline. And in terms of the sensitivity curve improvement, so this is plotted here, taken from a recent paper by Sarah Gossin. So this blue curve is this LIGO A+. This is sort of the limit of where we expect current technology will get us with quantum materials improvements that we're counting on in order to get to A+. The gray line is actually what produced the results that you've seen so far. So all the astrophysics that we've been able to do so far have been produced with the gray line all the way at the top. Where we're trying to get to on the scale of decades is this pink and green curve at the bottom. So Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope. And how big is this really? So on the scale of 40 kilometers, it's most of the way from Toronto Center to Guelph, to give you a sense of scale of how long it might take you to commute from the corner station to the end station if you needed to do an upgrade or replace something. And what would this buy us in terms of the science? So what's the motivation for building these so much larger? So in terms of cosmological reach of how far away we'd expect to confidently observe mergered signals, so here's where we are at the present day. We expect that the limitation of this current generation or the second generation of detectors is going to get us out to about a redshift of 2, so roughly about the local universe. However, if we are able to build these next generation facilities, we would see absolutely everything. We would see all the mergers all the way back to the dawn of cosmic time for stellar mass black hole mergers. So this is our third generation target. And in addition to a really phenomenal reach, we'd also get these very precise signals. So really, really large signal to noise ratios. So for comparison, I've plotted this time series of the first detection. So this is the very first discovery of gravitational waves in terms of Whiten strain, where we've normalized by the average noise curve here. So just to draw your eye to roughly the handful of cycles that we're able to resolve really well. The scale of this signal passing through the advanced LIGO detectors as they were in the first observing run is only on the order of milliseconds. However, if we were able to build Cosmic Explorer, there are two curves here. So the one in the background in this kind of orange-yellow color. So this is, again, the limitation that we expect for second-generation detectors. And then the blue curve is the curve that we expect for Cosmic Explorer. So we'd go from getting a handful of cycles to potentially hundreds or even thousands of cycles with this really exquisite precision in our measurements. And this would unlock a lot of potential science in terms of tests of general relativity. And then for lower mass sources like neutron stars, also the neutron star equation of state. And we do expect to see, were we to build these detectors, many, many of these signals. So this is based on some astrophysical population synthesis models. Each one of these yellow dots here is an expected neutron star merger. Each one of the gray dots is a binary black hole signal. We are here in the center. This is the neutron star detection that we saw a simulation of earlier. This is the distance relative to us at the center of the first detection of gravitational waves. And then each of these dashed lines is the horizon for some different detector configuration. So I'll draw your eye to Cosmic Explorer out here at the boundary for neutron stars, and then for black holes, where we have this observation bias that because the signal at the source has so much higher amplitude, we're able to sense much, much farther out for these higher mass sources. We would again be able to see incredibly vast cosmological distances with these detectors. So what does this mean in terms of what we would see? So for the more common neutron stars, we expect possibly a merger every 100 seconds. So it's a lot of overlapping signals. If you remember how long a binary neutron star signal is in a gravitational wave detector. So for binary black holes, about once every 5 minutes. But for both of these, we'd be, again, getting these really incredible signal-to-noise ratios. So how are we going to get there? So we need to get from here. So this is the current limit, projected limit, for this generation of gravitational wave detectors. We need to get from there, which also requires an improvement in quantum materials, down to here. So the total noise in this Cosmic Explorer noise budget. So this assumes some really big advances in quantum materials. And I'll point out this projected specs for Cosmic Explorer. So here for reference, this column is the specifications for LIGO A+, which again is the limitation of the current generation. And then we've got Cosmic Explorer Phase 1, Cosmic Explorer Phase 2. So there's a lot of information on here, the arm length, the suspensions, the core optics. And I want to draw your attention here to the test masses. So here we've got some projection for the substrate material that we're building the mirrors out of, as well as their mass. So please notice that really, really big increase in mass. So this is going to make us a lot more resistant to radiation pressure, but it's also a really big engineering challenge to have mirrors that are so large. And then also temperature, where again, the first phase of Cosmic Explorer would be at room temperature. And then like Einstein Telescope, the second phase would have a cryogenic element. All right, well, to get our bearings, so where are we starting from in terms of the thermal noise of coatings? So here's a tour of our current coatings. These are the thin films on the surfaces of our optics, which are again at room temperature. So we developed these to be a Bragg reflector. So that means we've got alternating layers of material with a thickness of a quarter wavelength. And the alternating materials are this titania-doped tantala, which has this good refractive index. And we've got this silica. And what silica does for us is it has a really low, what we'll call loss angle. And we'll see that this is the parameter that we use to determine what the mechanical loss or the contribution to thermal noise is going to be for the coating. So we've got a material with a really good reflective property and a material with a really good thermal noise property. And you might be wondering, well, why not just make it colder? That sounds great. Keep doing what you're doing. And the answer to that is that it's a little bit more complicated. So this is a term that's describing the contribution to displacement noise from these the thermal properties here. So let's assume that we keep some things constant. So we've got a contribution from the substrate. So this is whatever we make the optic itself out of. We've got a contribution from the thickness of the coating. Let's say we don't change that to keep it at the same reflectivity. And then also the beam radius, we'll keep all of that the same. So if we just change the temperature, if we just take the temperature down, we're not necessarily going to get the behavior we expect because of the way that this mechanical loss term behaves. So I'll show you an example for one of the two materials, this silica, that we're using in the current coatings. So here is room temperature, and you see this really, really dramatic dip. This is a log scale plot, by the way, in terms of this internal friction. So this inverse Q will see the same thing as this phi term here, the mechanical loss. So going to lower temperature doesn't necessarily help us. In fact, it would harm us for the current materials that we're using for the coatings. So in addition to that, we're still going to need all the same properties. So we're still going to need something that's really highly reflective for our target wavelength, that also has low absorption and low scattering, and we need a really high quality coating over a tremendously large surface area, so up to 60 centimeters in diameter for these next generation optics. So there are some candidates, so I've listed a few here in teal that the field seems to be considering as possible options. But as far as I know, nothing is really ruled out. So the field is pretty much wide open for someone to make a discovery that would advance our understanding of materials in a way to meet these specifications for gravitational wave detectors. So I'll say just a little bit more about mechanical loss so we can all build our intuition about what this is. So you can think about this mechanical loss angle phi, which is also the inverse of this, this Q that's damping term that we saw on the last slide. So we can think about this in terms of the complex stress-strain relation. So if I break this into its real part and its imaginary part, and I rearrange it a little bit, I can write this loss factor in terms of this angle phi. So essentially, I can think about this as the phase delay between some applied stress and then the resulting strain. So that's what phi is in terms of how it's governing this dissipation of mechanical vibrations. And how do I get it? So how do I measure phi if I'm looking at candidate materials? So I can leverage that if a material is going to experience a lot of mechanical loss, it's going to have a really low Q. It's going to damp down really quickly. And if it's got really low loss, I expect it to ring for a really long time. So what we tend to do, one strategy that seems to be pretty common to all the different approaches that you could use to try and measure this mechanical loss, is to introduce some kind of an impulse into the system that has your coating and measure what happens. So if I can measure the ring down, then I can get Q, and if I can get Q, then I can get phi. And generally a strategy is to do this for some kind of a substrate without a coating, and then to repeat the measurement with some kind of a film on top, so whatever your candidate coating is that you're trying to test. And then any difference between these two ring down measurements must be due to the film. So if I can measure the decay time for each one of these configurations, then I can infer what the phi is of my material. So this is generally the approach, and this brings us to the UBC team. So this is an effort of entropy by design. So this is part of one of the grand challenges that the team at the Quantum Matter Institute is spending a lot of time thinking about. So this is a collaboration of a team that can synthesize these candidate materials using MBE. And there's also a team that can characterize them with a lot of experience, particularly in cryogenic measurements. And then also wrapping all of this up together is a theory and modeling effort trying to predict new candidate material directions for us to explore, both in terms of component materials and also in terms of potentially these annealing processes that we might apply to them. So I'm going to be sharing you what they've been working on, and this effort is really fortunate to be supported by a New Frontiers in Research Fund Exploration Award. So if you're a condensed matter physicist or an astronomer and you're thinking about teaming up and you're wondering if that's interdisciplinary enough for the New Frontiers in Research Fund, the answer is yes. I encourage you to also explore those kind of collaborations, because we've found there is quite a bit of overlap in terms of some of the ways that we think about these problems. All right, so to give you a sense of the context, so here are some of the current measurements, these other methods that the field uses to measure loss angle. So I won't go through each one of them, but I will emphasize that there exist current methods that are very high quality. Some of them are cryogenic. However, because they target the frequencies where gravitational wave interferometers are sensitive, that means that the substrates that they're using are pretty large, so on the scale of centimeters. And that means that they have pretty low throughput. So it could take hours, if not days, to do the setup and the measurement just for one measurement of one candidate material. And that's if everything goes perfectly to plan in that process. So also because the substrates are larger, that tends to require more of the material that you're using as your candidate coating to be tested. So with that in mind, I'll introduce the UBC approach. So this is a microdisc approach, which is a much higher frequency range than gravitational waves are sensitive to. But what it does allow is this really, really high throughput testing. So on a small chip, you can fit about 100 microdiscs. And essentially, the way these are manufactured, so they are etched with hydrofluoric acid to sit on this little pedestal of silicon dioxide. And they use a very, very small amount of material for testing, and we can get a rapid measurement of 100 microdiscs per chip for each measurement. So another benefit is that you can do some really neat things like vary the materials as one of the parameters that you're testing. So we have a huge parameter space to explore in terms of possible material candidates and combinations for coatings, as well as annealing procedures that might change the mechanical noise properties of the materials. So what you might consider doing is doing a gradient coating where you're varying the ratio of your materials and testing that. And then along another axis, what you might do is change the geometry of your chip, and that will change the mechanical frequency that you're measuring when you do your ring down measurement. So you can wrap a lot of different parameters into a single test. And you know, in the span of roughly an hour, you could have all this data ready for you that's going to guide those the measurements that are made at lower frequencies. And here's the team, well, Kirsty, I should say. So the astronomers paid Kirsty a visit. So Kirsty's really been leading the charge on this effort, and this is the setup that she's built. So the microresonators go right in here in this vacuum chamber. And then the way that the measurement works is you have some laser beam that you're shining down on the chip. And then for each one of those micro resonators, you're reflecting that beam onto a photodiode. And then when you generate some kind of an impulse, you're watching essentially how that beam is moving, and that's capturing the motion of each one of the microdiscs. So Kirsty reports that they recently performed their very first ring down measurements, which to me as an astrophysicist looks beautiful. So this is a ring down of one of the geometric modes in the microdiscs. So this is really exciting to see to come together. So this is an effort that's been going on for a couple years now. And meanwhile, in the synthesis lab, so this is an MBE deposition lab led by Kajo. So this lab is capable of depositing very high quality thin films with a huge variety of materials. So it's a great match to the kind of parameter space that we're hoping to search through. So they also have exciting news to report relative to the characterization effort. So they have now successfully shown that they can deposit a thin film coating with essentially no deformation to the microresonators. So as you might imagine, these are extremely sensitive to any kind of an impulse, and they can become distorted or warped. If they were after the coating, so this is before and this is after, we would see signs of this in terms of deviations in the way that the light is reflecting as it's captured in this image. So since it looks very uniform, this is a really, really good sign that they've overcome this problem. And we're in a position, we're right at the precipice of UBC starting to make many, many measurements that are going to inform how the broader field is targeting these different candidate materials. And all the while, We've got the theory effort as well that are looking at a possible mechanism of internal friction. So look, thinking about two-level systems as driving this internal friction where you have these thermally activated transitions between potentially these two different energy states that are introducing this dissipation. So using some simulations, so graduate student Daniel Wong has just produced some results that indicate that it could be a really small number of two-level systems in a broader material that are producing most of the dissipation. So this is something really interesting that we're following up on, and this is also an area that's, let's say, open for many other contributions if this sounds really interesting to you. All right, so I wanted to close with just a couple minutes on Cosmic Explorer, thinking about where we might build something this big. So where could Cosmic Explorer be built? And a really central problem here is that it would cost quite a lot of money to build one of these in order to make this laser fly straight. So this is a requirement. We need 40 kilometers in two different directions where we're overcoming essentially the curvature of the Earth. So if we leave the Earth's surface unaltered and we follow this zero elevation line, by the time we get to 20 kilometers down our 40 kilometer long path, this change in height is actually in the order of 30 meters. And when you integrate this all over 80 kilometers and a little bit of width also, it turns out to be pretty expensive. So this is an analysis done by Francois Skidcat at the University of Montreal that's following the steps of Kevin Kuhns, who's part of the Cosmic Explorer study team. So what they did is they assumed some platform width and some dollar amount to move dirt. And it's noteworthy that it costs the same to move dirt whether you're digging a hole or pushing the dirt to fill in the end stations at either end. It costs roughly about the same amount. So thinking about this all in all, if we just choose a site with no alteration whatsoever, yes. So this is for one arm, this number. That's for one arm. So you would want two arms, and the US is thinking about building two detectors. So that's a really, really big number for moving dirt around. However, if we make a smart choice about geography, it's possible to choose a site where you have concave elevation in two different directions, such that this delta z is on average about zero. If we do that, we reduce the cost, at least for digging, for dirt moving, by two orders of magnitude. So let's keep that in mind. So here's an analysis that Francois did via Google data showing the sites, not only the sites, but also the potential orientations of the sites that fit this criteria. So here, the colors show how much dirt you would need to move in order to make this laser go in a straight line. So red is actually the best. So these red sites require the least amount of dirt moving in either direction that you would move the dirt. And what I want to show you now is that take a look at the sites that are in the States, and now take a look at the sites that are in Canada. And it's also worth noting that this high density of sites near the border here is sitting on this Canadian shield, which is really seismically stable and would help us to reduce a lot of the potential noise sources from ground motion. Another point that's worth making is that all of these sites overlap with unceded Indigenous territories and nations, and Canada has a lot of experience to bring to bear on forming productive partnerships with these Indigenous stakeholders in such a large project. All right, so with this, I will leave you. So we're 6 years out, almost seven, from the announcement of the first detection. And as an analogy, so here is Galileo's first sketch of Saturn up above. And then 6 years after, some improvements with his telescope, this is what he sketched. And then here's 400 years later, our image of Saturn. So just imagine where we'll be with gravitational waves even decades from now, and we're going to need these improvements in quantum materials to get us there. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. Jess, are there any questions? Actually, maybe if I could seize, could I ask a question?
Sure.
I noticed that the Cosmic Explorer performs a little bit worse than Einstein Telescope at low frequencies. Is that because Einstein Telescope is underground and Cosmic Explorer would be too expensive to put it underground?
That's a really excellent question. So they're designed with different science goals in mind. You might have also noticed that Cosmic Explorer performs a little better at higher frequencies. So this would be better for some of these other exciting sources that we might detect, like Korkalep supernovae, or depending on the frequency range, neutron star sources as well. So there's that element, but it comes not only from being underground, but also really big differences in the engineering design. So you might remember that the suspensions for Cosmic Explorer were, you know, a factor of three or so longer than current detectors, but Einstein Telescope is planning to make that more like a factor of 10. So they also have a xylophone design where they're stitching together a cryogenic low frequency interferometer together with a room temperature interferometer that's meant to mitigate shot noise. So they sort of have this funny noise curve that sort of looks like two interferometers put together, and that's the reason why. Great question.
Any other questions?
Thank you for the talk. It was great. A question which is kind of orthogonal to what you have presented. I think the fundamental principle which the experiments that you have described is based upon is that gravity changes the location of the mirrors, kind of, or the curvature between the mirrors, and through that, we can detect the gravitational wave through because it influences the interferometry. Is it possible that directly couple gravitational wave to the quantum degrees of freedom? For instance, currently we have experiments which shows the entanglement between particles which are far away from each other. Is it possible through such kind of experiments to detect gravitational wave?
I don't know of any mature designs along those lines. I think if we were able to do that, it would be really neat.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Is there any hope of measuring corrections to classical gravity using the signal from gravitational waves?
Could you say the first few words again for me, please?
Like, is there any hope of measuring deviations from predictions of classical gravity from the gravitational wave detection?
So deviations from general relativity?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And this is something that the broader gravitational wave community are actively thinking about, and gravitational waves from black holes, particularly of lower mass black holes where you have really extreme space-time curvature, are very promising. And one of the most, I think, compelling science cases for building an instrument that would give you such high signal-to-noise ratios.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Excellent talk. One thing I was wondering, which is in a bit of analogy to some work I did on like ion trap experiments a while ago, is there any difficulty in, say, like doing a multiple reflection to kind of extend the, I guess, the phase difference and kind of increase your signal noise ratio by considering multiple reflections along a single line of your laser?
That's a really interesting question. Maybe we could chat about how much overlap there is between that idea and the idea of cycling the light many, many times in an arm. Yeah, I think that's a great question.
Could I just ask, do I get the correct impression that in terms of trying to find materials with very high Q, that you're basically not or to what extent, maybe I should say, is one guided by theory there? To what extent can you kind of know in advance which ones will be good candidates, and to what extent are you kind of trying everything you can think of?
Well, as I'm here at a theoretical institute, I will say not as much as we would like. But that's my sense also. Speaking as a bit of an outsider to the condensed matter aspects, it does seem that the progress that's been made so far has been dominated by sort of serendipitous experimental discoveries.
Because I was thinking also, so kind of that question that, so what is strategy actually right now in the UBC? So with the Kezo's sort of a lab, I mean, are you sort of depositing so randomly? I mean, there must be some guiding principle. I mean, this is an experiment, so there must be a guiding principle, even though it is not guided by theory.
Well, I will do my best to reproduce my understanding of their strategy, but I can also get you in touch with them if you're interested. But my sense is that the next step is going to be to reproduce the results that we're seeing from the materials that we are currently using for the detectors to make sure that we can replicate those, and then from there start with deviations to those materials that look potentially promising. Absolutely.
Very interesting ring down measurement. So in principle, this loss angle for bulk motion can be different from the loss angles for the shear motion for generic material. Have you guys thought about measuring these loss angles separately from ring down measurement?
That's a really good question. So my understanding is that, so the, you might remember back to the equation that we were looking at for the contribution of thermal noise to the overall strain noise. So we tend to parameterize the bulk motion of the substrate in terms of its Young's modulus. And there are quite a few efforts going into making sure that the substrate that we choose is not going to become a dominant source of thermal noise. So right now, that's been a successful effort to the point that it's the very thin film on the coating that's limiting.
Yeah, I guess I'm talking about the loss angle of the coating. So the bulk motion of the coating could have a different loss angle from the bulk shear motion of the coating. So,
yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think I'd have to ask Jeff Young and Kirsty how they're parameterizing that in their measurement. But I'd be happy to get you in touch with them if you like.
All right, so with that, oh, okay, one more question.
Hi, this might be a very naive question, but do the mirrors have to be a single slab with a coating, or can you make the, or can you just like take a big slab of granite and like bolt a mirror onto it?
Well, I think coming back to the last question, so I know very little about granite, so I can't speak authoritatively to the properties of granite, but we do want to make sure that we're careful to choose a substrate that's not going to be introducing any noise into the measurement. Yeah, that's another really good question. Yeah, I think I wish I'd brought the whole team with me for for fielding these kinds of questions. Yeah, I think maybe we could take that question back to them.
All right. Well, let's thank Professor McIver one more time for a great talk. And there are snacks.